This morning, as I left my house, I grabbed three things: my car keys, my wallet, my smartphone. Chances are you did the same. And if you're like me, you check your phone and social media early in the morning, before going to bed, and who knows how many times in between. It's so much a part of our daily routine that we don't even realize we're doing it. Not only that, we have little or no idea about what our smartphones and social media might be doing to us. Today, I talk with author Chris Martin about how to push back on the hold technology has on our hearts and minds on this episode of Youth Culture Matters.
From the Center for Parent Youth Understanding, this is Youth Culture Matters. If you're a parent, youth worker, educator, counselor, grandparent, or anyone else who cares about kids, we're glad you've joined us for this practical, informative, and hope-filled podcast. This is a place where together we talk and think Christianly about the rapidly changing world of today's children, teens, and young adults.
Well, one of the stories some of you have heard me tell from time to time is the story about all the questions I used to get, 15, 16, 17 years ago when I travel to speak in a community or at a church to parents, and we'd be talking about culture, and then there'd always be one or two, and it actually started to get to be more than that as time went on, moms who would come up to me and say, "Hey, I've got a question for you. My daughter says she's the only one in her school that doesn't have a cell phone. You know, when do you recommend that my daughter gets a cell phone? When should I allow her to have a cell phone?" And I was hearing this all the time, and my answer was consistently the same: I don't know. I just didn't know at that time. And so, as with anything we study here at CPYU, we started to immerse ourselves in a bit of, the reality of what was happening with digital technology, specifically with phones. This was obviously before the smartphone in 2007 with the iPhone. But we started to look at theory, we started to look at scripture, and we wanted to take a good approach that was biblically grounded where we could give people some good advice. And out of that grew what we call our Digital Kids Initiative. And as we studied social media, as that came on the scene more and more, as we studied smartphones and technology and the effects of these, we started to think more and more just about discipleship. You know, this is an avenue where, or an area of life that, if Jesus is truly Lord over all of life, shouldn't we, as individuals, as parents, as youth workers, be thinking about how we and the kids that we love and nurture can bring honor and glory to God through the way we use these things to advance our human flourishing rather than to undermine that? And so, you know, what we started to do is what we do here with, we call a practical theology. That's nothing new to us, but Richard Osmer, you've heard me talk about this before. You know, he says when, as practical theologians, and certainly parents and youth workers, this is us, you know, there's four questions we need to ask. We sit back and we observe. We say, what is going on? We ask, why is it going on? Then we go to the scriptures to think about what ought to be going on. And then we get very practical, how might we respond? How might we celebrate and affirm the things that we see are good, true, and honorable? And then how might we bring about change and lead ourselves and our kids more into conformity to the will and the way of Jesus Christ? And that's why I'm excited to talk today to Chris Martin. Chris Martin has done this, and he's released a new book that just came out at the beginning of February of this year. And the book is called Terms of Service, subtitled The Real Cost of Social Media. Chris has got a great cover, and we're really happy to have you here. Chris is now a content marketing editor at Moody Publishers, and he's done a lot of work in social media over the years. And for those of you who are listening who are youth workers, Chris is one of us. He's been one of us for a long time, so he brings a lot of experience to this. And I'm glad you're here, Chris.
Hey, glad to be here, Walt, and just really excited to help out however I can, and I hope both our conversation and the book, if people decide to read it, is helpful. And yeah, like you said, man, I'm super passionate about this. I've been working in student ministry about since I was a student. I started serving in the student ministry of the church I was going to when I was in college, just a few years older than the students I was serving. And and so getting into plenty of trouble with them while also leading them, right? And then also all the way to today, I've served on staff as the youth minister at our church. But then now, as of right now, I'm just serving as a volunteer in the student ministry. So I'll be there. We're recording on a Wednesday. I'll be there later tonight and helping out there. So yeah, this is obviously something that not only social media, but youth culture and serving students in this way is very close to my heart. So yeah, for sure.
Now I have to ask you, when you're there tonight, are you working with middle schoolers or high schoolers or both?
Both. So I go to a relatively small church. I mean, on a global scale, it's an average sized church. About 300 folks attend our church, but it's a pretty young church. So we have a giant kids ministry, of which my wife and I have contributed one in the last couple of years. And then, because our church is pretty young, our youth ministry is small relative to the size of our church. So we've got 25 students in our combined middle and high school gathering. So we only add, like, it's only growing larger every year. Even if we don't add kids from the outside, they're aging up from our huge kids ministry. So it's been fun to watch that ministry grow over the years.
So obviously this is near and dear to your heart, not just because of who you are and what you've done vocationally, you know, how you've had to think about this vocationally, but you're now a parent, and eventually, you know, who knows what's going to be on the horizon. Wait, do you have a son or a daughter?
Daughter. She's almost two.
Yeah. So she's two now. And let's see, probably in about 4 to 6 years, you're going to be getting those questions, you know, dad, mom, you know, when can I get on social media or have a smartphone? I've got grandkids now who are around that age, and they're really, really interested in the screens. And so also in your ministry at the church, and we'll circle back to that later and ask you about some of the things you're doing there and some of the things you're seeing with kids, but what you might be doing in terms of some of the responses and, you know, borders and boundaries for the kids as they come to ministry. But I want to talk about the book. And in the beginning of the book, I want to ask you about the title first, because it's a very unique title, Terms of Service, and you describe why you use that title in the book, why you chose that title. So I want to hear a little bit about that, but I also want to hear about what it is you're trying to accomplish with this. And I love the quote, I'll prompt you with this, from David Foster Wallace, which you can, you know, mention what he says as well, because that's just a great way of thinking about just about everything in life that we're immersed in.
Yeah. It's the title, Terms of Service, it was kind of a joke, frankly. Like, I started a newsletter around the beginning of 2021, I think just before the pandemic, I forget the exact day, but and I named the newsletter Terms of Service because I was trying to come up with a funny name to talk about how social media affects us in ways we don't realize. And the whole thought behind the newsletter title being Terms of Service was, you know, we all lie about reading the terms of service for these websites or social media apps that we sign up for. So I'll write a newsletter called Terms of Service, and maybe people will actually read this one, right? Because none of us read the real terms of service. And so when it came time to propose the book 3 or 4 months after I'd been writing that newsletter and decided, hey, there might be an actual book here, I was like, well, I'll just title the book the same thing, kind of tongue in cheek. Nobody ever reads the terms of service, but maybe they'll read this terms of service. And there's kind of a double meaning that I think there, this is what I mentioned in the book, that I think there's a sort of hidden terms of service that we sign up for, that we agree to when we sign up for these platforms, beyond whatever legalese is in the actual terms of service or terms and conditions that are on these apps and platforms. And so that's the reason I called that. And I was kind of shocked. The publisher was like, yeah, that's actually a great title. Let's go with it. Cause cheeky, I work in book publishing, and I know that cheeky titles aren't always the best titles, so I wasn't expecting them to go with it, but here we are. And so, yeah, the beginning of the book, David Foster Wallace, just a great American author and thinker and novelist, he once wrote, and actually he first said it in a graduation commencement address at Kenyon College, but I came across it in his book, This is Water, which is just a book form of that same commencement address. He says, there are these two young fish, he's telling a sort of parable. There are these two young fish swimming along, and they happen to meet an older fish swimming the other way, who nods at them and says, morning, boys, how's the water? And the two young fish swim on for a bit, and then eventually one of them looks over at the other and goes, what's water? And I think that's a really apt illustration for where we're at regarding social media. Social media is the water in which we swim. And like fish, like the young fish in the parable, we don't realize that we're swimming in it. And I think, and this is why throughout the book and really throughout most of my ministry around this subject, whether writing or speaking or otherwise, my number one piece of advice is not just log off or just delete your accounts. I do think that can be helpful, like for a time, or if you find yourself addicted to it, or, you know, I don't think that's a bad step to take. So don't hear me saying it's not helpful. I think it can be, but I think if we think the answer to our social media problems is just deleting our accounts and logging off, we're just going to be frustrated and we're going to fail at that. A, either because our will fail and our discipline will fail and we'll get back on, or B, we'll come to realize that even if we successfully log off ourselves and delete our accounts, these platforms are still going to influence us and affect our lives, whether we like it or not. Much like a fish cannot live outside of water, even if he doesn't realize he's living in water, we cannot live outside of these platforms, even if we try to extricate them from our lives as best we can. And the whole point of the book, and kind of what I'm trying to do, is not say get out of the water, because again, I don't think we can really get out of the water fully. My goal is just say, hey, I think the water is toxic, or at least I want you to realize you're swimming in the water and the water is affecting you and your health, spiritual, emotional, mental, in plenty of ways. And I think it may be affecting you without you realizing it. So be aware. It's really a kind of just a call to awareness, if you will, a call out of ignorance. I definitely provide some practical steps to try to mitigate the effects, but I don't think there's not this silver bullet. I really just think it's a life of discipleship and growing closer to Christ and prioritizing the eternal over the temporal. But yeah, so that's the whole point, I guess, is to answer your question. The whole point of the book is not log off, social media, evil, never use. It's more, hey, let's have a more critical, thoughtful, and intentional relationship with these platforms so that maybe we can shape them more than they shape us.
Hmm. You know, as you say that, what I'm thinking about is there seems to be two sides of the spectrum of response, extreme sides that we see in the church. On the one hand, there are the people who are just, hey, it's here, and I'm going to use it. You know, everybody's doing this. It's going to advance my life. And so there's absolutely no thoughtfulness put into this. You know, I think about on that side, you know, Marshall McLuhan, who said, you know, first we shape our tools and then our tools shape us, which I thought was a brilliant statement long before there was digital technology like we know it now. And, you know, McLuhan, when he talks about that, he says it isn't until a short time later, I think I remember reading, you know, 4 or 5 years later, that we realize how the tools have shaped or maybe misshaped us. I actually think the time on that has shrunk, perhaps. And I hear, you know, many of the parents who, you know, take that approach after a couple of years, now they're wringing their hands saying, I can't peel my kids away from their phones. We've totally lost their attention. They're distracted, they're addicted. So on the one hand, you have that, you know, we're just not cautious. We're just not thinking. We're just going to, as you say, with the water, we're just diving in. We don't care. And on the other hand, there's that, like what you just mentioned, let's just turn the whole doggone thing off. And so a parent will say, you're not getting on there. You're never getting on there. I'm just not going to allow you to have it. Well, the problem with that is that we're forfeiting the time we have to nurture our kids into how to use these things in healthy, balanced, God-glorifying ways, and they become adults. And, you know, I've been around long enough to have spent a lot of time with people who were limited by well-meaning, well-intentioned Christian parents, you know, to not have this, that, or the other thing. And then they head off into their adult life, whether it's college or, you know, moving out or something else, and they then go over here, and they totally dive into it without thought because they've never been trained. Could you offer some thoughts on that, maybe some practical advice on that as someone who studies this and thinks about it critically and Christianly, you know, for parents who might be tempted to go one way or the other?
Sure. As we just talked about, I only have a nearly two-year-old. So I'm always, though I've worked in student ministry and I've obviously tried to walk alongside parents amid these issues a lot, I'm always hesitant to give parental advice to like teenage parents because I'm not one. So understand that I'm speaking from an unexperienced perspective in that
yeah,
regard.
Let me interrupt you there and just say, you know, you've seen enough, you've studied this enough that you can say to parents, here's what I've seen happen that's been good. Here's what I've seen that's been bad. And here are the habits that lead to both or the practices that lead to both. And I'm sure you think about that, you know, with your own child.
Yeah, I mean, the book is dedicated to her, and the dedication says, "For Magnolia Grace, this is why." And it's a bit of a cryptic little message, but what's going to happen is one day she's going to beg me, "Daddy, why am I not allowed to be on social media?" And I'm going to say, "Maggie, go get that book off the bookshelf. Daddy wrote it a long time ago when you were a baby. Pick it up, look at the first page." And she's going to look at it and say, "For Magnolia Grace. Oh, that's me. This is why. Oh, this is why I'm not allowed to be on social media." To your point, I think you're exactly right. And this applies to in a lot of areas of life that parents may differ in terms of conviction and how to handle these things. But I think that especially in regard to the internet and social media, which is my area of expertise and the only one I'm confident in speaking into, I think parents should be wary of both extremes, as you describe, letting their kids dive in and become like screen slaves to their phones or whatever else. And let's be clear, not all screen time is created equally. Like, there's some screen time that could be very helpful and very edifying and very good. I think screen time can get a bad rap sometimes because it's not all Fortnite or whatever. You know, I mean, it's not all fun or entertainment. Like, there are some good things that can be done, but I think their parents should be hesitant toward that. But especially in Christian communities, like, I've come across a lot more parents who are super restrictive. And what I've said to parents like that is, wouldn't you rather your kid mess up in your care? Wouldn't you rather your kid make mistakes and grow using these platforms while they're under your roof? Because you're not going to keep them off these platforms forever. I mean, they're going to go off either to college or the work world or wherever else. And they're not going to be, and so then they're going to learn, and they're going to have to make mistakes on their own without your care. And if you're, depending on the nature of your relationship, they may not come to you for help at that point. So what I would say to parents is measured, like, teach them how to use them. What you said is exactly right. I can't really put it any better. Like, teach them how to use them. Be gracious when they mess up, because you know they're going to, and be grateful that they messed up in your care rather than in a place where maybe they feel lonely and isolated, in a spot where they feel as though nobody can help them with the ways in which they've messed up using these platforms.
Mm-hmm. That's really good. I love that. You know, and one thing I think about, we talk here a lot about having a healthy, you know, we need a healthy doctrine of grace, right? But we also need a healthy and vibrant and robust doctrine of human depravity and sin. Because if we don't have that, we may be led to believe my kids are going to do okay if I tell them not to go down that road. Or my kids are going to do okay if I just dump them in that pond or in that fishbowl. And the reality is, we need to realize that they're just like us, they're broken. And I think sometimes that's why we're so cautious. We're afraid they're going to do the things that we did. And, you know, and we need to realize, well, they probably might, or do other things, because there are other playgrounds now on which to indulge your sins. So this is so good. We're going to take a break. When we come back, I want to have you dive in a little bit to this. You say this right at the outset of the book. When we chain ourselves to our preferred social media platforms, we give up more than we realize. Social media may not cost anything, but it isn't free. And so I want to talk about some of the costs and have you address that, not just for our kids, but for us as adults as well. So we'll take a break. We'll be right back.
If you enjoy listening to Youth Culture Matters and would like to support the ongoing efforts of this ministry, you can do so by visiting cpyu.org/giving to make a donation. Your prayers and financial support make this podcast possible.
Well, we're chatting with Chris Martin, who's the author of a brand new book, Terms of Service, The Real Cost of Social Media. It's published by B&H Publishing, and you can probably get this book just about anywhere, and you should. I love this. You know, I ran across it, I think I said this, I ran across it on a table at a conference I was at, and I'm always like, oh, man, books, you know, and my wife is, you know how sometimes if you're really into books, you have a wife who is sort of monitoring your intake. You know, it's like if you eat too much pizza, my wife will tell me that's enough. And I got this one and kind of hit it for a little bit, but it went right to the top of the pile. I thought, man, this is just great. So Chris Martin, thanks for writing it. Now, before the break, I mentioned this particular couple of sentences in the front of the book. You said, when we chain ourselves to our preferred social media platforms, we give up more than we realize. Social media may not cost anything, but it isn't free. And I want you to speak to that. You know, help us unpack that. Let us see what the cost is. And I also want to hear from you. You know, when I just read this now, when we chain ourselves, it's interesting that somehow we go to the social media platforms, and sometimes I think they throw the chains and wrap the chains around us. And I know you've written about that as well. So let's hear a little bit about what the cost is. And parents and youth workers, really listen to this, because, again, this is where we're at. We need to step out of ourselves and kind of look objectively and see what our decisions, the implications of what our decisions actually are.
Yeah, man, I think there are costs of various kinds, and all of us maybe pay different ones, different kinds of costs, just depending on how we're wired and how we use these platforms. I mean, the heart of the book is kind of part two. It's titled Five Ways the Social Internet Shapes Us. And I think those ways that it shapes us are kind of the costs. I think, like, my biggest, I mentioned this briefly in our first segment chatting together, that my biggest concern with our relationship with social media and the social internet more broadly is that we're letting it shape us. You use that McLuhan quote, like, we're letting it shape us more than we're shaping it. And that these tools, as they were presented to ostensibly serve us, we've really come to serve them more instead. And I think the way we do that is by using these platforms uncritically, without asking hard questions of them. And what I mean by that is, like, have we ever asked, like, what does scrolling Instagram do to me? Like, how is Instagram shaping my understanding of the good life? Or when I get in an argument on Facebook, is it edifying to me or anyone else? Have I ever changed my own mind or changed others' mind in my arguments on Facebook, you know, in the comment section of a local news post or something like that? I just think that a lot of us adopt these technologies and these forms of media without asking how they shape us. And that's concerning to me. So I think a lot of the costs revolve around that. Some of the more specific ones, like, I think we trade our privacy for personal expression. So I'm big on privacy, like data privacy, personal privacy. My wife and I made a pretty conscious decision when our daughter was born that we aren't going to post any pictures of her online for the foreseeable future. We will at some point, almost surely. But I believe strongly in, like, individual digital autonomy. And that's kind of a fancy phrase, but, like, I want my daughter to be able to veto anything I post of her on the internet. And some parents might think that's silly or whatever, but I think it's important. Like, I don't want her to feel violated in some way, or even as a young child. So I think trading privacy is kind of scary. Go ahead.
Yeah. Let me ask you about that, because, you know, I'm on these platforms and I see what people are posting, and I see what people I know who are, you know, solid in their faith, moms and dads, many times it's more it's moms, are posting things, you know, in terms of pictures and that kind of thing. And I get that there's two concerns I have with that. The one is, you know, comparison and identity. You know, am I putting my kids, are you putting your kids out there, you know, to make yourself feel better about yourself because you're looking at everybody else who's posting? And what you don't realize, it's that moment. I tell people all the time, like, a lot of times when I go speak, people want to say, you know, tell me about your family. So I'll often put up this picture from a family wedding that we had just a year and a half ago. And there we all are, all dressed up, grandkids, my kids, my wife and I, standing against a barn. It's one of those, it's just a perfect picture, right? And everybody looks, well, and I say, there it is, folks. There's a perfect family. That's what you have to compare yourself to. And let me just tell you, that was that one split second in time when the camera, you know, grabbed it. That's not, that's what we look like, but that's not who we really are. And we compare to that, you know, and so, and then we find our identity through our kids, which is a concern as well. And then the other thing I would say is, and I want to go back to this, what you said about you don't want your daughter growing up and at some point looking at the two of you and saying, what in the world were you doing putting me out there? And there's a lot of research now, you know, that's coming out of kids who are coming of age who mom and dad have had smartphones, and from birth they were just, you know, plastering their social media sites with pictures of the kids, and the kids are going, "Why did you do that? You never asked me." I gave you a lot to respond to there. I'm sorry, but
no. They're, like I work with kids in student ministry who are who are teenagers and are embarrassed by what their parents post about them online, and I just think that's a problem. Like, I think that can hinder trust with teenagers, with young people. I think, you know, it's I don't know if I mentioned this in the book or if I've just written it elsewhere, but I think it's kind of crazy. This is just kind of a microcosm, like a small example of the fast adoption that we've kind of talked about here, like the fast transition that concerns me and concerns you for similar reasons. If in 2003 you told parents, and like I was 12 or 13 in 2003. So if when back then you told parents, hey, in 10 years, which would be 2013, in 10 years, it's going to be totally normal for you to be posting pictures of your kid on the internet. And even like in the bathtub and like, you know, half clothed, it's going to be totally normal for you to be posting that kind of thing on the internet for all of your friends and family and possibly the world to see. That will be normal behavior. They would have looked at you in 2003 and said, "You're crazy. I won't even put my credit card in that thing. And you're telling me I'm going to put pictures of my kid online?" But now, like, we made a decision in 2020 to not post pictures of our daughter on the internet. And people kind of came to us and were like, "Are people upset? Like, that's kind of weird. Like, is your family mad at you about that? Like, how do you get away with this? Like it's like they, like, we're the weird ones for not posting pictures." The fact that that's happened in such a short period of time, that swing from "you'd be crazy if you do it" to "you're crazy if you don't," really concerns me. And I think it's kind of a microcosm of how quickly we've moved, and perhaps without much thought. And you know, one of the biggest pushback I get, especially in Christian circles for some reason, to this idea is, well, I don't have anything to hide. Like, why do I care if Facebook is like mining my data, or you keeping my pictures, or, you know, all, whatever other privacy concerns are of conversation. And I'm like, well, okay, look, I understand maybe you don't care. It's not like some engineer at Facebook's like paging through all your pictures or something like that. But I was like, you do care about privacy because you close the door when you go to the bathroom. Like, we all care about privacy. We may not want to, like, we don't have anything to hide. You can not have anything to hide and still value your privacy. And I think we should. And I think it's important for us to do that, not only for ourselves, but for our children, like you were talking about. And I just don't want, when my daughter is 12, her to stumble across my wife's Instagram or my Facebook and be like, "Now, why'd you do that? Or what? Like, I don't understand." And that's just not a conversation I want to have. And I want her to be able to veto, like, it's her life. And I don't want to depict it in a way, for all the reasons you described about comparison. And like, I think using kids as content, that's the way I can describe it. Like, using kids as content is one of the most cruel things you can do to a child and not get in trouble for it. I just think it can be really cruel and really, really mean. And even if you're being nice and bragging about your kid, I think it can turn dark quickly without you realizing it. And so yeah, that's some of it, but there's a whole other set of costs too.
Yeah. If I can just throw in, one of the things we've been working hard to tell parents is that when, you know, you think you're doing a good thing when you're posting your kids, especially in a moment of accomplishment, right? When you're posting it out there, that the problem with that is that can backfire on you, because as your kids see that, they start to think, "Man, mom and dad, they're really only impressed with me when I do something great," right? And that creates this pressure for a kid. And if you're in a family with multiple kids and some are higher achievers than others, now you've got the comparison going on among the kids. You know, look, so much has happened as I've gotten older. You know, parents, it's interesting to me that, you know, 30, 35 years ago, there was this movement that started in the church and elsewhere to think about the way that we were parented influenced us for either good or for bad. And so many people entered into counseling realizing, man, what my parents did to me was not, you know, not really good. Now, whether that's accurate or not in each and every case, I'm not here to judge that. But there's that reality there that I think we need to learn from, that down the road, There could be some fallout from this. You mentioned data mining. We hear a lot about facial recognition. Can you address some of that for us? And it's not just with putting pictures of our kids up there, but the kinds of things that we look for, because I know you go into a lot about the algorithms and how those work, and we just get fed more of what we're looking for.
Yeah, so I use the terms social internet and social media somewhat interchangeably in the book, but I use the term social internet more than I use social media because they are different. And I think it's important for us to think about the social internet, not just social media. So it's actually Postman, Neil Postman, who reading Amusing Ourselves to Death like 5 or 6 years ago is what really set me on this path of writing, frankly. And he does a really good job explaining the difference between a technology and a medium. So a technology is like the ones and zeros. It's the actual tech, right? So the tech is like the television. That's the technology. Or the actual internet, like the infrastructure of the internet, the code and the ones and zeros and the algorithms. Those are that's the technology, if you will. And then the medium is the culture you create on top of that technology. So it's the way you use that technology to create culture. So the television is a technology, but that reality TV show, that local news broadcast, that sitcom, that's all media, because that's culture that you're creating using the technology of the television. On the internet, we have the social internet, which is the algorithms, the code, the ones and zeros, that's all the technology. And the media, the social media, is the funny cat videos and the pictures of our kids or the pictures of the wedding or the blog posts that we share. That's the culture that we're creating on top of the technology. And what I think, we talk a lot about the media. We talk about watch this, don't watch this. You know, we talk about things that are good for us to consume and not good for us to consume in ways, you know, we talk about the media a lot. I think, and I think we should, like, I think there's plenty of good conversation that happens around, you know, why we should put certain, like, you know, boundaries on what we watch and don't watch. Obviously, all of that's important. But I think it's important also for us to look a bit more deeply at what you've just described, like at the technologies and how the technologies are shaping us and affecting us in ways we don't realize. The algorithm serving us more of what we want, which because we believe in depravity and original sin and we recognize that we're broken people, algorithms can often lead us deeper down that road. The algorithms are not designed to redeem our habits and our interests and our desires. They're designed to give us more of what we want. And that can be destructive, depending on how we're using these platforms. And so, yeah, like when it comes to some of the more technical things like facial recognition technology, I think that can be a problem. But perhaps the biggest user of that right now is Apple, who Apple has their own problems, especially in like their relationship with like China and stuff like that. But I trust Apple with my privacy 100%, because Apple makes no revenue off of my data. So like I have an iPhone, I'm an Apple guy through and through. I have an iPhone, I use Face ID. Actually, the way we share photos with our family members of our daughter, because we do not live close to our family. We live a solid 7 or 8 hours away from virtually all of our family. We use a shared Apple photo album that's private and only able to be accessed by a handful of family members. Because Apple does not share their data, their user data with anyone, any other companies. It's all housed locally on iPhones, et cetera, beyond whatever you put in their encrypted cloud software. So like I trust Apple, and one of their values is privacy is a human right. And so like that's like, sign me up. Like I agree totally. However, when you take a platform like Facebook, who is arguably the most egregious kind of like abuser of user data on the internet, they've routinely showed why they cannot be trusted with user data. They profit off it to the tune of tens of billions of dollars a quarter, hundreds of billions of dollars a year. They profit off user data and regularly have accidentally leaked it out and then have lied about that. And so like there, I think we should be wary to always be against or in favor of certain platforms or technologies and recognize that there are real people behind a lot of these things. And certain companies and organizations have proven in the past to maybe be a bit more trustworthy and handle our data and our use of their platforms more ethically than others. So like, I'm very interested in the future of the internet and like VR and the metaverse and all that, but you won't catch me with an Oculus Quest headset that's owned by Facebook, because the last thing I'm going to give Facebook is access to my eyeballs and my face. So like, I think like, but if Apple comes up with their own little headset kind of doohickey, and there's a way for me to explore that new frontier so I can learn about it, perhaps write about it, you'll see me signing up, because I trust that Apple's not going to go off and then sell my activity to some third party like Facebook has so routinely done in the past. So I hope that makes sense. Like, I don't want to wholly endorse or wholly outlaw certain types of technologies, but I do think that, again, it just comes back to thoughtfulness. Like, are we realizing what we may be giving up when we do these things? And is it a worthy trade? Like, is posting that picture of your family worthy of what may come of it, for good or for ill, moving forward? So anyway, that's a bit of a rabbit trail. But yeah, I think they're good questions.
Yeah. And now we're not just talking about how this happens with adults. We're talking about how this happens with kids as well. And I'm always a little wary on some of the social media and the smartphone technology stats. But I ran across one, because you never know if they're really up to date and how accurate they are. But I ran across one that says that 45% of American children ages 10 to 12 have a smartphone. Does that sound accurate to you? 45% of American children ages 10 to 12 have a smartphone.
I don't work with 10 to 12 year olds, like in the student ministry, or maybe just the top end of that. But I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah.
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 Yeah,
so,
I wouldn't be surprised.
So talk a little bit about that, because we're talking here. I mean, adults can be really ignorant. They have the cognitive capacities to not be ignorant. But when it comes to our kids, they're ignorant because they don't even have the cognitive capacities to really think critically through this, just because of where they're at developmentally. Talk a bit about, a word to parents about smartphones and kids.
I would delay it for as long as you can. Like, I'd probably try to go past that 12-year-old range to like maybe when they start high school. Again, there's no right answer here. You said folks used to ask you this kind of question all the time before they were even smartphones. Today, I still answer pretty regularly, I don't really know what to do about this. But I do think there's some merit, perhaps when they start driving, you know, for safety or things like that, to have some sort of technology to keep in touch. And perhaps even when they get to high school and perhaps they're doing a lot of extracurricular activities. But if you have a child who's in middle school or even late elementary school, and for some reason you believe they need a smartphone, I would ask why a smartphone and not a dumb phone, if you will, a regular cell phone. And then I would ask, what kind of safeguards do you have in place for them? Because I think, you know, what I always want to be careful of, and maybe we talk about this in another segment, but because it's a whole other deal. When I've talked to parents about their kids and social media and cell phones, I think what parents maybe who are very restrictive don't realize is that if you don't give your kid a smartphone or social media access by a certain age, you have effectively socially isolated them. Now, we can bemoan that all day and that say that it shouldn't be socially isolating if their kid's not on social media, but it's a reality. And I've talked to plenty of kids who are not invited to activities with friends or kind of socially ostracized because they're not a part of that group text message or whatever else. And I think that that can have serious negative effects on children, and we should be aware of that. But I do think that we should always be cautious about giving young kids below high school, below driving age, access to a cell phone, a smartphone especially, without serious guards in place through apps you can download and things like that to try to monitor their activity.
Yeah, that's great advice. So, well, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue to get more and more practical. This has been very practical to this point, very helpful, but we're going to look at maybe some best practices and talk a bit about some of the other downsides of our use of social media and technology. We'll be right back. Tens of thousands of kids have been trained by their parents and youth workers to think Christianly about music and media with our How to Use Your Head to Guard Your Heart 3D Guide to Making Wise Media Choices. This easy-to-use teaching tool needs to be in your youth ministry toolbox if you desire to teach your students to integrate their faith into all of life. Jesus calls us to follow Him, and that includes following Him into the 6 to 9 hours a day of screen time that shape and mold the beliefs and behaviors of our kids. To learn more about our 3D media evaluation guide, And to order a copy for every member of your youth group, go to our website at cpyu.org. Teach your kids to engage with media to the glory of God. So the day that we're recording this, I know it's a couple of weeks before it's actually going to drop, but the day in which we're recording this podcast, last night, the Olympics were still going. Women's figure skating, which has been quite controversial to this point, by the time everyone's listening to this, they're going to know what the outcome is of the big doping scandal. But something that many people may have missed, and I saw when I was flipping around, was, you know how, like, when the skaters are, they're the next one up, they sit off to the side and they're getting ready. You know, in my mind, I'm thinking they're getting psyched up. They're going through their routine. They're thinking about all their moves. You know, I don't know if they call that the bullpen like in baseball or not. But the camera focuses on an American figure skater, female, 16 years old, Alyssa Liu. And when the camera comes on her, she's sitting there ready, you know, getting ready to go, but her face is just buried in her phone, and she's swiping, and she's got her thumbs going, and the commentator said there she's getting ready, and she's tweeting, she's, you know, swiping through, she's on Instagram, she's connecting with her friends, and I just thought, you know, like you said, Chris, just earlier, you know, man, how things have changed, you know? And it's amazing to me. And so that was just like one little visual example of how these things have come in and just taken over our lives. And so I want to hear from you some practical thoughts. I mean, you've thought a lot theoretically. You've looked at the data. You've talked about all the ways that these things, you know, really start to own us. What are some practical steps that parents of teenagers and younger children, parents themselves, and then also youth workers in their ministries with their students, what are some practical ways that we can find balance, that we can bring honor and glory to God, that we can use these wonderful God-given tools redemptively rather than in ways that just undermine our well-being and undo us?
Yeah, I think first I want to reiterate something we talked about in a previous segment, that if parents can manage it, I would really advise parenting your children to giving them access to these platforms while they're still in your house, so that they can learn how to use them in your care. I just can't reiterate enough what I think the importance of that. Yeah, they're going to mess up. They're going to come across something intentionally or unintentionally that they shouldn't. And maybe they're going to send messages to friends that they shouldn't. The fact is they're probably going to do that when they're 25, if they don't do that when they're 15 or 17 in your house. And while we don't want kids to mess up, our kids to mess up in that way ever, they probably will. And so I think just that to have the grace and the sort of foresight to love them and give them metered and careful and restricted, but not totally restrictive access to these platforms while in your care, I just think could be so helpful for your children. I say that as somebody who's worked in student ministry and has not had to wrestle through having a teenager myself. So I just think that's really good. I think some of the tips I outline in the book, the part three, like where do we go from here, is a series of really quick hit, short chapters on just ways to root ourselves. Really, I think a lot of it comes back to like rooting ourselves in the offline so that we see the internet as subservient to our offline existence. Because unfortunately, I think that many of us have started to see our online lives as primary and our offline lives as secondary. Like we decide to go on vacation to a certain place because it'll make great Instagram content, or, you know, things like we post pictures of our kids. We ask our kids to do something funny so we can post a video of it on Facebook or whatever. And so I think a lot of my practical application or pieces of advice revolve around living life offline first and living life online second. So that looks like studying history. Like I think studying history and reading about people in history, events in history, is really helpful for recognizing that the most important things in life aren't what's happening online every day. Because it can become really easy to just get caught up in the latest controversy on Twitter or what your friends and family are doing and what they post on Facebook. And I think reading history and studying history can really help us root ourselves in the narrative of life that goes far beyond what's on our screens. I think admiring creation, I love going, I'm an amateur bird watcher, and I use that term in the loosest sense possible. And I love going on walks and not taking my headphones. We live right next to this beautiful park. And so we walk there almost every day after work if the weather cooperates. And so I think just like going on a walk and admiring the creation without taking your headphones and listening to a podcast, no offense, or a book, or even like, I mean, I take your phone if you might need it for like safety reasons. Like if you're, especially if like you're a woman walking by yourself, like take your phone, but maybe you just resist the urge to post that really pretty picture of the sunset on Instagram. I know it's hard. I do it myself, so I understand.
Can I just throw something in there as you're talking about that before you move on to the next thing? I love both of these. One with the history, you know, one of my favorite quotes is Francis Bacon, who said, "Histories make men wise, and we learn from history. It teaches us what to do and what not to do." You know, those who have come before us, biblical history as well. But the whole idea of, I love this, you know, admiring creation, you know, find something. You passed over it quickly, but, you know, amateur bird watcher. You know, people who are really into bird watching, I mean, they are just so immersed into that. It's almost a religion for some of them. I've seen them gather at certain places, you know. But to stop and look in a balanced way at the beauty of what God has made. And I call that out because I've discovered that more recently. And I'm just going to say, you are the first person. You mentioned this in your book, John Stott's book on bird watching, right? And I've never talked to anybody else who has that or who has read that. And I have it, and I've read it. It's just so helpful, you know, the theological, you know, the truths that the birds can teach us. So, I mean, that's just a great example. And I just, all I'm saying is, those two bits of advice that you've given so far, I mean, they're spot on. And we need to nurture our kids into this as well.
That book is called The Birds Are Teachers. Yeah. And our shared friend, Tony Reinke, I think is the first person who mentioned it to me. No, it was Justin Taylor.
Okay.
Justin Taylor at Crossway mentioned it to me, and I had to pick it up a couple of years ago. I think you can only get it used now. I don't think it's in print.
It's really?
So I'm sure you can find it on eBay or Amazon or something. But it's wonderful. It's a short book. He takes, like, it's a picture book, and he's taken all the photography of all the birds in it, and it's just tremendous. So yeah, I think those things are really helpful. I think valuing silence, like recognizing that your voice doesn't need to be heard all the time is really helpful. I think pursuing humility, I mean, that's always a good idea, right? But social media is so, it can make us feel so much like the main character of our lives. And it can really make it feel like everybody exists as an audience member to our lives. And I think actively pursuing ways to humble ourselves can really go a long way to fighting back against that sort of main character feeling that we can get when we post on social media. Establishing accountability, again, like pursuing humility, is so helpful in so many areas of life. And I think having friends, and what this looks like, it doesn't have to look super formal. I think what it looks like is just having friends who have permission to call you out when you're acting foolish online, or if they see you on it too much, or like if you have an iPhone, I'm sure this feature exists on Android phones as well, but you can set the screen time limits to where you can only use certain apps for a certain amount of time every day or between the certain hours of the day. I've done this. And you can give somebody else the passcode to where you can't even unlock it after you've used up your time for the day. So if you're like, hey, I only want to be able to use 2 hours of social media every day or 1 hour every day, you can set that limit. And when it's up, it's up. And if your friend who has the passcode doesn't let you back in, your spouse or a friend or whatever else, then you can't get back in. Your time's up for the day, and you'll come back tomorrow and you can watch whatever you need to watch or look at whatever you want to look at. But you have a certain amount of time. Like having those physical, like actual boundaries set can be super helpful. And then finally, this kind of flows out of the establishing accountability ideas. Just build friendships, like go to get coffee with people. Restrictions around coronavirus are easing. You know, we're getting perhaps into a nice spring and summertime where things will be as normal as they've been perhaps in a couple of years, depending on where you're at listening to this. And I think building real friendships where you're having friends over for board game nights and getting dinner together. I just think I don't think it's wrong to make connections with people online and maintain friendships online. But I think when we start to see internet social experiences as our primary form of community is really, and people might scoff at that, but it's real. I mean, people see their connections with others on the internet as their primary form of community. And I think that's a problem, and we should be aware of that. And we should be aware that we can slip into that if we're not intentional. So this goes back to the whole intentionality bit. Regularly have meals with other people, have them over for game nights or whatever else, and just don't lose the embodied presence of friends. So those are a few tips. We could talk about tips for a whole podcast in itself, but those are just a few that I would mention.
Just to take that last one that you mentioned on community a little bit further, I just listened to a podcast, an episode of Carl Truman and Todd Pruitt's Mortification of Spin, where they talked about, you know, the virtual church, the meta church that's now being invented and, you know, propagated and promoted, and just the dangers of that and how it really does undermine community, Christian fellowship. We'll include a link in the episode notes, the show notes for this podcast, to connect to that. But that was a really good episode and a great example of the kind of thing that you've done in your book, Chris, in terms of thinking theologically, thinking critically and Christianly, you know, about this. You know, because we might jump in and say, oh, this is great. You know, we can have church all the time, everywhere. And we give up so much, and we give up so much that's at the crux of this. You said you're going to be meeting with your youth group tonight. Any borders and boundaries that you would recommend? Maybe some that you folks in your church have instituted and use with the students when they show up on a Wednesday night? Or any more that you would recommend that you're going, man, in a perfect world, we would be doing this, and this as well. What would you have to say to youth workers about that? Because they're always asking. You know, I see it on the Facebook forums, youth ministry forums, you know, news groups all the time. You know, hey, what do you guys do about smartphones on retreats? Or what do you do about smartphones at, you know, Wednesday night Bible study or the youth group meeting?
Yeah. So when we do, or we have a summer retreat every year in July. Past few years, we've gone to the Smokies. This year, we're going to West Tennessee. There are no phones allowed on retreat. So that's a no phone zone, if you will, outside of leaders having theirs, obviously, for safety reasons and such. So no phones on retreat. And that took some teaching, but the parents were largely on board, even if the students weren't. So that was good. And then on Wednesday nights, we don't make everyone give up their phones on Wednesday nights, but that's, I know we've talked about that in the past, but we've found that it's not really a problem. And this is where it's probably more of a youth group by youth group thing. We found that students hang out and talk with one another. They're not just standing around on their phones. And that's good. I think that's a testament to probably a lot of activity from parents in our, the parents of students in our youth group, and our students really like each other. And a lot of them don't go to school together. So a lot of them, like, this is their one of two times a week that they actually get to hang out and talk and see each other in person. So, so we don't restrict phone use on Wednesday night as far as giving them up because we haven't really had a problem with it. However, we definitely do encourage that they read, that they bring paper Bibles and use paper Bibles when we're together on Wednesday. And so we have like church Bibles, like many churches do, pew Bibles, if you will, though ours aren't in our pews. And so we provide students with loaner copies of Bibles if they don't bring their own, so that they're not using their phones, just because, not that we're like anti-phone Bible all the time or anything like that, but we know that they can easily flip over to whatever they want to be doing instead of paying attention during the lesson on Wednesday night. So yeah, those are a few steps we've taken. And I think it's important not to be hyper legalistic about these things, but I do think that just recognizing that some boundaries, like we've talked about, can be really helpful toward helping students have a just healthy relationship with these tools while we're all together. So I think those are good. And I think any steps toward them could be really helpful.
Any thoughts, last question, any thoughts on the future? Like, where do you see things going? I kind of hate when people ask me that question, but I don't hate when I have to ask you. So put you on the spot. But, you know, you've thought about this and you've watched these developments in this one particular very large aspect of our lives. What should we be looking for?
So without spending a ton of time on it, like, we're currently in Web 2. Web one is when the internet was pre-social media. So that's when like we are largely just consuming content from the internet. That was web 1.0. We currently live in web 2.0, which is the read write era, as it's called. So where we're consuming content from the internet and creating content on the internet, primarily through social media and other such avenues. We're quickly approaching web 3.0, which has been called the read write own era, where you might start to actually be able to like own your content on the internet. Cause if you post something on Facebook, you don't own it. Facebook owns it. And so, where you can own content, perhaps make money from it. This is where you hear talk about cryptocurrencies and the metaverse and all kinds of frontier technologies. And there's a good deal to be excited about. There's also a good deal to be concerned about. And I think it's really important for us to not shun these things before they're even here, and also not uncritically embrace them before we've learned about them. So I think we could, you know, I think unfortunately a lot of Christian organizations or churches ignored social media for too long. I've said that the best time to learn about social media was like 15 years ago, and the second best time is now. And I think a lot of churches and Christian organizations are too far behind on social media because they ignored it too much early on. And I don't want us to make that same mistake with this new iteration of the internet, however that, whether it's the metaverse or whatever it looks like. I think we should not shun it. However, I do think we should embrace it very critically and very intentionally, and not uncritically just start holding church services in the metaverse with no real thought about what that could be doing to us. And so I think there's a lot of things to be excited about, a good deal to be concerned about. A lot of folks are very utopian in their conversations about Web3, and I definitely want to pump the brake on that sort of idea. But here's what sometimes people, you know, the book is, a lot of what I write, including the book, is kind of discouraging, as you can imagine. I mean, I think a lot of us are pretty familiar with how social media can be fun and be entertaining. No one needs to write a book about here's why social media is cool and why we all use it. Everybody's kind of aware of like why we use it. It's entertaining. It helps us connect with friends or family. There are redemptive parts and good parts to social media, but I think a lot of us aren't aware of the bad parts, which is why I write about that, to bring them to light, kind of drag them out into the light. But a lot of folks will ask me, are you optimistic at all? Like, do you have any sense of optimism for the future? And here's my optimism. And I think parents listening to this might understand, because we were talking about our ages. And I think before we were actually recording the podcast, talking about just like how you raised your kids about about phones in the early 2000s. And like, I grew up in a home, my dad worked for IBM my entire young life, and he worked from home. So like I was on the internet when I was like five, right? But I had no idea. I couldn't get into anything bad if I wanted to, right? I was just like goofing around and had no idea what I was even doing. So I have a really long history with this stuff. And so my parents, when I was in high school, I feel bad for my parents, if you will, because they were having to learn how to parent a kid on the internet and with a cell phone before anybody in human history had to do that. Now, there's nothing new under the sun, but this is about as close as we've gotten, I feel. They had no model. They had no archetype. They had no example of how to parent a kid who could get on the internet and do whatever he wanted at any time. And so I feel bad for them. And I turned out pretty okay, but I made my own mistakes along the way as well. Gratefully in their care, before I was out of their care. And so I think where I'm optimistic is that my hope is that teenagers today, who we may be collectively concerned about being in youth ministry, frankly, I think a lot of, you know, this might, you may disagree or agree with this, I don't know. I've heard a lot more wisdom out of the mouth of today's teenagers regarding social media than sometimes I've heard out of their parents. Now that I'm not saying teenagers are smarter about social media than their parents are, blanket, but I think a lot of teenagers today, even as they make mistakes and use it in foolish ways, kind of have an understanding of the ills of social media in a lot of ways that their parents didn't. And maybe their older siblings didn't 5 and 10 years ago or so. Just because the ills of social media are talked about a lot more today than they were 5 or 10 or 15 years ago, back when I was growing up with these platforms. Back then, it was just all new and cool. And what does this do? And now it's like, ooh, like I've heard a lot of negativity toward Instagram from high schoolers today, much more than I was hearing toward these platforms 10 years ago. And so where I'm optimistic is I think that young people are maybe starting to get a more realistic, balanced view of these platforms than they have had in the past. And where I'm optimistic is in 10 years or so, 15 years, those teenagers today are going to be married and parents of their own. And my hope is in a generation or so, when Gen Z are parenting their own teenagers, that maybe maybe we're moving in the right direction and they've learned their lesson to the point that parents and kids and social media is bound by less friction than maybe it feels like it is today. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And I hear you. I'm trying to process it, you know, from my life before smartphones, when I was an adolescent. My parents had no clue what it was like for me to walk the halls of my junior high, my middle school, you know, and how painful that was. And I think, you know, what you're saying, I would liken it to that. And I'm, you know, what you're giving me here is some hopeful optimism, obviously here. I mean, it's funny how you talked about, you know, people think you're just so negative because you're pointing out the bad things. I'm thinking to myself, yeah, we experienced that here. I mean, but you became a curmudgeon at a much younger age than I did as a result of that. So that makes me feel a little bit good, but I'm pretty curmudgeonly now, I guess. But, you know, as you look at these things, but I think, too, what you just gave us was something hopeful to pray for. I mean, specifically to pray for our kids that as they grow up, the negative experiences they've had, God would use them in redemptive ways to bear fruit in wisdom as they raise grandchildren, you know, get their parents' grandchildren. And yeah, that's good. I like that.
Yeah, like I think my parents did as best as they could with what they had, given that they had never had to deal with this before.
Oh yeah.
But I would like to think that because I dealt with social media as a teenager, I will be a little bit more equipped to parent my child when she's a teenager dealing with social media. Now it will look different, but there will be social media of some kind.
Yeah.
She will have the ability to connect with her peers in her pocket at all times, whatever that looks like. And so my hope is that because I had that ability and I recognize the havoc that it could wreak, not just because I write on it, because I experienced it, that I'll be able to help her from a sort of experiential perspective that my parents were not able to because they had never experienced it. In the same way, my hope is that today's teenagers in double their lifetime, you know, when they're 30, 32, that they could parent their children with even more knowledge and even more experience. And so I just have hope because we're starting to learn these things more. And I do think, man, like you said, I think it's a great point of prayer that teenagers today, the lessons they learn either from mistakes they've made or just from living life, that they could be even better at parenting kids and their relationship with social media than even their parents have been with them.
Yeah. This is so good. I really appreciate the conversation we've had. And for folks who want to get the book, Terms of Service, The Real Cost of Social Media, you don't read this book and then be done with it because, Chris, you actually have a newsletter. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. It's also called Terms of Service, kind of like I mentioned in the first segment. And it's a newsletter. You can go to www.termsofservice.social or just like Google Terms of Service, Chris Martin. The book will come up and the newsletter should come up. I'm on Twitter. Again, I'm not anti-social media, so I'm on Twitter. That's where I connect with a lot of folks who want to talk about this kind of stuff. And my Twitter handle is @ChrisMartin17. And the newsletter is actually in my bio there. So for anyone listening, that might be the easiest way to get to it is on Twitter @ChrisMartin17, and it's there in my bio. And man, I love talking about this stuff, especially with student ministers or volunteers in student ministry. So if anybody's listening and they want to chat about it, I love chatting about this stuff either like this on a show or a podcast, or also just in DMs or emails or whatever else. So I'm happy to talk about it.
Yeah, and I really appreciate the way you serve the church. So thank you for joining us. Chris Wagner, can you just say a word about how folks can access the show notes for this, the episode notes?
Sure. Go to cpyu.org on our homepage. Look for episode 147 and click on the link, and you'll be able to access all the show notes there and links to all the things that Chris Martin has mentioned in books that have been mentioned, and we'll provide all the links right there on the site.
Great. Thank you. Chris Martin, thank you. I didn't even
– Thanks, man.
I'll say this, first when I picked up your book, I'm thinking, you know what people think when they see your name? I'm not going there.
Okay.
There. But
Understood.
I just went there. So
all I'm saying is this. Nobody's ever seen us in the same place. Well, about 30,000 people in Indianapolis' Verizon Music Center did one time back in 2009 because we were in the same place. But nobody's ever seen us in the same place.
Right, but they were looking at the other one.
Yeah, yeah, right. You don't know what I do on the weekends.
Yeah. Well, we want to have people look at this one. So thank you so much.
Thanks, man.
All right, folks. We'll talk to you on the next episode of Youth Culture Matters. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for joining us for Youth Culture Matters, a podcast from the Center for Parent-Youth Understanding. If you'd like to learn more about today's youth culture, visit our website at cpyu.org. And if you have any questions, comments, or feedback, email us at podcast@cpyu.org.